Welcome to another episode of the Civitas Podcast, which is a public expression of the Theopolis Institute and that emerged out of a reading group connected to Theopolis that focused on post-liberalism and readings of classical liberal thought. And what emerged out of that was Peter and I deciding to co-host a podcast to continue to work out these ideas together, especially also with other friends and great thinkers. We are privileged today to have Brad Littlejohn as a friend of both Peter and I's from various different contexts and projects. And so we're thankful that he's joined us here today. A little intro for our audience. If you don't know Brad, he's the founder and president of the Davenant Institute. He's currently a fellow in the Ethics and Public Policy Center's Evangelicals and Civic Life program. He's formerly a senior fellow of the Edmund Burke Foundation, of which a public face is the NatCon, National Conservatism Conference, where Brad and I spoke at last year together. He completed his PhD under Oliver O'Donovan, writing on the political thought of Richard Hooker. And he publishes articles on all sorts of topics related to ethics and politics in various platforms. And I'm sure many of you have read some of his works. He's one of the most important contemporary voices helping retrieve classical Protestant political thought, but also with an eye toward renewal for our present social and political context. And he's recently made a case for what he's called a Christian Commonwealth, which we're going to discuss somewhat at length in this episode. But I wanted to start, before we just jump right into that, Brad is also, so our project is related, what Peter and I are seeking to do is articulate a particularly ecclesiocentric post-liberalism. So we're teasing that out. But even on that word post-liberalism, Brad has written and spoken about that quite a bit. And so I wanted to begin kind of launching with Brad's understanding of post-liberalism by focusing in particularly on his presentation where he said, we're all post-liberals. And so, Brad, would you maybe just expand on that? What does that mean? How do you understand what post-liberalism is? And why did you make the case that basically all politics is post-liberal now?
You should have said, I also have the distinction of being Peter Leithart's first ever master's student, I believe. Mm. Is that correct, Peter?
Yeah, you were certainly in the early class, one of the early classes, yes.
Yeah, well, first master's graduate, so I think so. Anyway, you can blame him for everything that follows. So on post-liberalism, yes, an idea I've been kicking around is the definitions of liberalism. It might be fruitful to break that down and turn, like, people mean different things by the term, and it could be useful to kind of apply Aristotle's four causes and think about, like, what some people talk about liberalism in terms of kind of material cause or efficient cause. But I think the most important, as for Aristotle, is the final cause, and that's what I focused on in that talk, with the idea of liberalism announcing a new understanding of what the end, the final cause or purpose of politics is, where traditionally, going back to classical times, and as summed up in the New Testament, the task of politics is to punish the evil and reward the good. Paul speaks of the magistrate as him who approves the good, and Peter also is the one who rewards the good. So there's both this negative and positive element to the political task. It's not merely about restraining vice, not merely about preventing harm. It is about, at least in some sense, fostering virtue, promoting, rewarding, acknowledging, praising virtue. So that's pre-liberal politics. Liberalism, on this definition, I would say, is an attempt to limit the task of politics only to the negative, the punishing or restraining of vice. And then even more than that, generally, it's not even just the restraining of vice, it's the restraining of harm understood in terms of physical harm alone, right? So this is what, I mean, the real classical liberal position is that the sole purpose of politics is restraining harm to sort of physical bodies and property, right? Your skin and your pocketbook, right? So I argue that that's no polity has actually been consistently liberal, classical liberal in that sense, if that's what classical liberalism is, because it's anti-human. As humans, we don't, first of all, we recognize that we are souls as well as bodies, and so we are concerned about harm to souls. We're concerned about harm to intangible things like a person's reputation. I mean, even, you know, liberal societies have always had, you can sue someone for harm to reputation, and not just because maybe that decreases their earning power, but because of reputation, someone's honor is seen as something important in itself. So we recognize that there are immaterial goods, and we also instinctively do seek to use our political institutions to praise that which is good. We have war heroes, and we erect monuments to them, and we maybe get them pensions and various forms of honors. So politics has always done that, but I would say particularly what we're all post-liberal now in the sense that what we see in the rise of identity politics and wokeism is this the use of politics to fight back against what are seen as really, really important forms of immaterial harm. That your speech you may not have physically attacked me, but your speech is an attack upon my identity, my sense of who I am. So not merely bodily goods, but soul goods are sort of back on the table as something that politics is concerned with. And we also are using politics now to advance a certain ideal, but social virtue is in terms of tolerance, or maybe not tolerance anymore, anti-racism, whatever the case may be. So the left has really abandoned that minimalist sort of John Stuart Millian vision of liberalism, and the right is increasingly abandoning it as well. And in a sense, no society has ever actually consistently been liberal in that sense.
Yeah, can I jump in here with a question from one of your essays? And it's not something that's unique at all or original with you, but you describe the state as having oversight or jurisdiction of external temporal goods or the external temporal sphere. That's a pretty common description of the state's scope. But how does that square with the idea that there are immaterial goods that the state is responsible for, that it's responsible to promote virtue, which is what you started out saying? External temporal sphere sounds like you're talking about behavioral constraints, which seems very consistent with what you described as a liberal order.
Yeah. A couple things could be said there, right? So, there are more things that are external than, speech. Let's talk about speech, right? So speech is an external act, but speech is not an inflicting of bodily harm, right? So we could say you could have sort of three possible positions. One in which the state is concerned with regulating internal belief and thoughts. The state should be engaged in sort of thought police business. A few totalitarian states have sort of tried to do that, but of course, in some sense, that's impossible. The only way in which the state can regulate something is to the extent that it's visible and externalized in some sense. On the other end of the spectrum, you could say that the state is only responsible for
bodily harms.
Yeah, for bodily harm, right? Whereas speech is an external act that is nonetheless that can inflict mental harm, but does not inflict bodily harm, right? So I would say that's a sort of intermediate position there. I would also say although virtue, virtue has both an internal and an external component, right? Virtue is created by habits. Sort of habits alone are not virtue. You can just sort of become a automaton, just sort of reflexively doing the same thing over and over without thinking about it. And that's not virtue. But just having right intentions, not married to good habits, is not virtue either, right? Virtue happens at a space where repeated physical action translates into a posture of soul, right? So that's where the pedagogical function of law cannot produce interior virtue directly, the way the working of the Holy Spirit can, but the pedagogical function of law can aid in the production of interior virtue by fostering certain bodily habits, by holding up before people certain ideals to be emulated or internalized, et cetera.
Yeah, but as part of the positive role of the state, that the state has an interest not just in the external facsimile of virtue, but having actually virtuous citizens. That's part of the state's interest. That's in the state's interest.
Correct.
And understand that you're not, you can't exercise some kind of negative sanction against internal states. But when you start including the positive role of the state, then it seems you're breaking the boundaries, it seems to me, of external concern, jurisdiction over externals, even though you might have only direct control or jurisdiction over external behavior. The intention is to create at least a set of circumstances that promote virtue.
And so would you say it's then like indirect? Is that what you're kind of, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I said the state's limited to externals in two senses. One in which it's cognizance, right? It can only know that which is externalized. In a sense, that's not unique to the state. That is any human being, any human institution can only know that which becomes externalized. And the tools with which it acts upon people are merely external tools, right? It cannot make use of the sword of the spirit. So, but it observes external behavior and it uses external tools with the aim of shaping the internal sphere as well. Yes.
Yeah, and of course, my interest in that question, and I'm interested in the question by itself, but my interest is also the flip side of that, which is, If you set it up as two distinct jurisdictions, the state has jurisdiction over external temporal realities. The church on that paradigm would have jurisdiction over internal and spiritual realities. But I'm assuming that you're making the same kinds of qualifications on that side as you would on the other, that there'd be external actions that would come under the jurisdiction of the church.
Yeah, well, that's a key part of why when I talk about two kingdoms, I stress two kingdoms is not distinction between church and state, strictly speaking. The church, in as much as it is a visible, historical, temporal, external, you know, apply what adjective you want here, institution, likewise, only has cognizance of external things and only uses external tools, right? So the church has a kind of a dual identity as both a sharer with the state in the temporal kingdom and as an instrument of Christ in the spiritual kingdom.
And so they're both, because one of the terms you used, I can't remember which essay this is in, because now I just have my notes randomly compiled here, is that they're both in a sense concerned for soulcraft then, but they just have different tools. Is that also, would you say that? Because one of the arguments you make in one of your essays is that the state is also, okay, I guess this is in we're all post-liberal now essay, which is that we're returning to the fact that it's inevitable that the state is concerned with soulcraft. And so I guess the argument there then being that they're both concerned with soulcraft, but they have different tools at their disposal.
That is true, but there's still a distinction of ends, right? The state is concerned with soulcraft in as much as that soulcraft rebounds, like it uses external tools to indirectly affect internal realities so that those internal realities will then sort of rebound positively into the external, right? Into the temporal. So the state wants good, like virtuous souls in its citizens, not because it's concerned about the state of their souls as such, but because it wants good citizens and it wants a stable, orderly society and a peaceful, and it recognizes that you don't achieve that simply by kind of behaviorism, by sort of, you know, coercing people into line, but actually by fostering good people. And the more you foster good people, the less, in fact, you have to use coercion. So the states, there is still a distinction of ends, right? Whereas the church is interested in soulcraft because it wants to form good souls so that those souls will, in fact, become fit vessels for entering the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, but on the second part of that, doesn't the church have an interest in the rebound into externals? I mean, you have various kinds of spiritual tools, as it were, ecclesial tools, word, sacrament, discipline, rebuke, prayer, liturgy, whatever. All these different things that are forming souls and forming people, but that produces a certain kind of life in the now.
Yes, absolutely. So right. Yeah, so it's a both and for the church. Right. And it's, but for the state, it's the only horizon is the temporal. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't want to focus on, we're going to talk about Christian nationalism. Yeah. I don't want to focus on Stephen Wolfe's book, but Wolfe, as I understood it, was talked about the state having an interest, not just in the souls of citizens for the sake of citizenship, but the souls of citizens in preparing them for heaven. So you're disagreeing with that. Or did I misunderstand? Are you thinking I misunderstand what Wolfe was getting at?
Yeah. That's a good question. I think what I would want to say is, I'd have to look at the passage. If he says the state has an interest in preparing for heaven. I mean, what we could certainly say is the Christian magistrate is both a magistrate and a Christian. Mm-hmm. And as a Christian, he of course wants to see as many people as possible mm-hmm. redeemed. As a magistrate, that's sort of beyond his purview. So now it happens to be the case that he can sort of kill two birds with one stone, right? Because as a Christian magistrate, he believes that the best way to produce good citizens is also to produce people who are followers of Christ. And so therefore, as magistrate, his aim is to produce good citizens. As Christian, his aim is to produce fellow believers. And he can pursue both those in parallel, but I think still with something of a distinction of vocations.
Well, maybe this will give that's an opportunity for then to us jump into the Christian nationalism and Christian Commonwealth project. So, Brad, you published a lengthy essay, I think originally at Ad Fontes and then reproduced at EPPC, on a case for Christian Commonwealth in conversation with the whole Christian nationalism discourse. And so, could you explain kind of what motivated you to write this piece? And then kind of what you were attempting to articulate as a distinct position. And then we can kind of tease out how we want to follow up with that as we progress. But yeah, kind of what was the cause of that essay for you?
Yeah, sure. Well, the biggest cause is I think there's just been massive terminological confusion around the term Christian nationalism, which is, I mean, it's one of these things that seems to be primarily defined by its critics. And then some people have just sort of like said, sure, call me a Christian nationalist. I am a Christian nationalist. But it means very different things to different people. And so it seems to me to be too confusing a term to be worth sort of trying to rescue and run with for a constructive project. I would say at least three understandings of it that are fairly commonplace, and then I'll say how Christian Commonwealth relates to that. So one would be Christian nationalism is just Christians who are also nationalists. If you, the title of Ad thing forefronted this. So a Christian nationalist is simply a Christian who believes it's okay to be a nationalist and make theological arguments about, say, rightly ordered loves and so on, as to why it's appropriate to love and privilege the interests of your own nation over those of other nations. There's a lot more I could say on that, but anyway, so broadly, there's that one, right? Mm-hmm. A Christian who is also a nationalist. Then there's, I think, the critics who use the term are particularly pointing to a kind of phenomenon of American folk religion, which doesn't see America as simply a Christian nation, but as sort of the Christian nation, the kind of chosen nation, where there's America is serving a particular, like an important role in God's purposes. So if America fails, God's purposes fail. And so that's what motivates kind of this sort of rabid, we have to stop the steal or, the Jericho March, whatever. Because if we don't save this thing, then the church is going down too. Kind of, I think that kind of mindset you can see in some of, in a lot of the people that are kind of being chronicled in, say, the book Taking America Back for God. And what's striking about quite a number of those is they often aren't that religious. They might not even go to church. For them, Christianity, to say America is a Christian nation is almost more of a kind of an ideal, a kind of cultural signifier than an actual theological proposition. Kind of shading over from that is Christian nationalism as a form of identity counter, you know, sort of right-wing identity politics, where to speak of like a Christian nation often there's a sort of Trojan horse of assumptions about the culture and ethnicity and maybe even race that has characterized this historically Christian nation. And that, of course, is where I think a lot of the controversy has been around Wolf's book. To what extent does his brand of Christian nationalism, is it really smuggling in other identity markers, including possibly racial ones, as part of this Christian nation that needs to be retrieved? So against all of that, I want to say there's another thing a fourth thing that could be meant, which is simply the idea of a Christian state, the idea of Christian government. And when some people attack Christian nationalism, they're attacking the idea that laws should be self-consciously Christian. Like basically anyone who doesn't accept the premises of neutrality and actually wants governments to govern Christianly, they're a Christian nationalist. So I want to say, let's separate that discussion from these other senses of Christian nationalism, because, I mean, you could be... So I want to use this term Christian commonwealth to highlight the fact that you can believe that governments should govern Christianly and not be committed to the nation as that political form. I do think the idea of Christian commonwealth does highlight something that Christian nationalism is trying to get at, which is... So I don't want to just use the term, say, Christian magistracy, the idea of a Christian magistrate, because I think it's important to understand that laws shape culture, but culture also shapes laws or determines what is possible to achieve by law. So you can't just have, you know, a Christian, say, you know, whatever, a Christian king come in and say, okay, I'm just going to make this people Christian by law. Christianity has to be cultivated through all of the mores and customs and ways of life of the people. And so I think the idea of Christian commonwealth is trying to capture that idea of a sort of reciprocity between law and culture within the Christian polity.
So now I'm putting words in your mouth, but just to expand briefly there, would you say also that's where your project retains even a sort of kind of conservative impulse, kind of against a kind of a reactionary or kind of one? Would you use those terms as you express that kind of organic, you know, life of the people bubbling up? It has, you know, not just the top down change there.
Yeah, I think actually that is an important point of difference I had with Wolf's book. The most striking passage of it that I remember, I was just like sort of wrote what with exclamation points in the margin, is where he's talking about the conditions under which resistance or revolution might be justified. And he basically says it's legitimate for a Christian minority to rise up and seize control of the government and then enforce Christianity by law, even against the wishes of a majority population. And that doesn't seem to me to be like most of the rest of that chapter. He's relying on historical exemplars and the Reformed tradition, talking about the conditions of like when you have tyranny, when you can resist and so on. There he seems to be going off on his own. And I think that's, I just think as a conservative, I would say that's not practical. Yep. You cannot impose a new vision of the good just sort of purely from the top down against a recalcitrant majority population. Mm-hmm. So the conditions under which Christian, like you can make laws that are sort of more Christian, that nudge people in a more Christian direction. But if you've got an anti-Christian population, then you're going to have to work very slowly and gradually. And an actually Christian polity is going to require both the top-down effect of law, but also the leavening influence of the church on culture.
Yeah, so that gets to the question that I had about, and I'm thinking particularly of the essay that James brought up, Christian nationalism or Christian commonwealth. And you're talking about the, yeah, and I agree with this, that you can have a top-down imposition of a vision of the good. You oughtn't, but you can have that. That's, it has been done. It's been tried. But the question I had is how you see that occurring. And your comment at the end there is that it's through the work of the church that you have a Christian people formed, which is then that Christian peoplehood or Christian commonwealth or Christian culture comes to expression in law. So you end up with a bottom up and a top down thing. But it's crucial for the church to have it. The church's ministry is crucial to that formation of that bottom up, both, but particularly the bottom up side of that process.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, I mean, this is how the reformers understood it, right? They were trying to, as they saw it, build authentically Christian polities out of what they saw as a very sort of corrupt and superstitious, you know, it was Christendom in a sense, but it was not really Christian in many ways. And so what the Reformation is trying to accomplish is this formation of a Christian people by the coordinated action of Christian magistrates and Christian ministers, and magistrates creating the conditions necessary for the ministers to do that leavening work. And of course, it involves coercion. I think Timon Klein has a great line on this, where the coercive conditions, some great C alliteration. James, do you remember?
Coercive conditions conducive to conversion.
There you go. They're creating the coercive conditions conducive to conversion. So I think that is what the state does, and coercion is part of it. I think in our context, part of this is the result of civilizational learning over hundreds of years over what maybe does actually work best. Part of this is just an acknowledgement of different expectations in our cultural context. Those coercive conditions are going to be rather less coercive than they were in the time of the Reformation, right? We're not actually going to, we're not going to be burning Servetus at the stake. I'm probably not even going to be exiling Servetus. But that doesn't mean that we can't put the weight of the law on one side of the scales rather than the other in order to render people more receptive to the teaching ministry of the church.
Yeah, it's interesting in your answer to that. You seem to, in the Reformation example, and the direction of your answer to that question was interesting. I brought up the question of the church's role in forming the kind of bottom-up renewal that you're talking about at the end of this essay. And you moved into talking about the role of the state in supporting the church's ministry and creating the coercive conditions, CCCC, that are conducive to conversion. Is that what it is?
Yes.
But we're not in that kind of situation, and we're not going to be in any foreseeable immediate future. So it seems like the church's activity has to be, the church is the place, is the one thing that we can control, as it were. It's the one thing that we can do as Christians that can foster this renewal. If the aim is to renew the nation, it seems like the church's work is primary in that. And that, you know, what is the solution to the disarray of American civilization? It's evangelism. So are you saying something different from that?
Yes. I mean, obviously I would agree with most of that, but I don't think it follows that sort of there's nothing, like what I sort of hear you saying is, until the church has done a lot more work in evangelism, there's nothing that can be accomplished by way of a Christian politics. And I would disagree with that in a couple of ways. So one is, I think this can sound trite, but I really think it's actually quite significant, which is the role of the statesman as moral exemplar. So, you know, when people talk about different kinds of regime, they understood that different kinds of regime correspond to different character types. There's a character type that sort of signifies, corresponds to a different type of regime, and a statesman who has that character type can, just by the sheer force of his example and personality, help foster that regime type. Angelo Codevilla has some great remarks on this in his book, The Character of Nations. So what that means is a Christian who finds himself in a, Christians should seek, they shouldn't just find themselves, Christians should seek positions of political influence in part so they can simply, in those offices, model, display, articulate the Christian virtues in a way that will have a shaping effect on the population. That's one thing to say. Second thing to say is, in the role of education, you know, I think obviously church-led education is absolutely crucial. And the best, I would say the best education is going to come kind of from the private sector. But I don't believe it's remotely realistic for, you know, I think for the foreseeable future, the vast majority of Americans, both at the sort of primary school level and at the college level, are going to be educated through public institutions or institutions that at least have some kind of public support. And this has been the case for most of history. Like public, like education requires public funding. So I think the kind of stuff that, let's say, Ron DeSantis is doing, where he's really recognizing like education is where the battle is at. And this is where you, but just from very early on in someone's life, teach them to shun what is evil, and you praise and reward and approve that which is good. So I think that you have to be careful and sort of baby steps in how you do that, in terms of like how much explicit Christianity are you trying to put into the public education system. But I think there is important work to be done there, and we don't just sort of have to wait for revival.
Yeah, right. I wouldn't say that there's nothing that that Christians can do politically. Part of the question would be what counts as Christian political action, but I'll leave that question to the side, because I would say that evangelism is Christian political action. But the thing that struck me in your answer, and also in the essay, is you talk about this renewal. We wanted this restoration of a Christian world, similar to what the U.S. was founded with, a kind of Christian commonwealth that was there at the beginning, but without any reference that I could find in that part of your essay to the work of the church in fostering that. And that seemed like a big oversight. And I wondered if it sounds like that was not intentional, because you're saying that evangelism and the church's ministry are crucial to what you're talking about. And even something like a political leader is an exemplar. Yeah, I agree with that. As Christians are called into those kind of positions, they should pursue them and seek them and model public virtues. But where do those kind of people come from? What kind of church is actually forming people that have that sort of character? And I do think that's a matter of discipleship. It's something that comes mm-hmm. through the work of churches.
And even when they get into those places of power, of temporal power, what role does the church have in continuing its discipleship, even as they're right. in their places of political office? Yeah.
I mean, I'm reminded of, I used to say the problem with James Davison Hunter's To Change the World, it talks about faithful presence mm-hmm. and explains, but really it only explains how to be present. It doesn't explain how to stay faithful while mm-hmm. being present. Mm-hmm. And the reality is most people, when they try to become present, lose their faithfulness. And then Dreyer's The Benedict Option sort of talks about how to stay faithful, but not how to be present. And we got to be able to put those two things together. So, I agree with that. I mean, if it was omitted in the essay, I would just plead the fact the essay was already 7,000 words.
It never stopped you before, Brad.
I was going to say it was Little John-esque already.
Yes. It was Little John-esque. It wasn't quite Alistair Roberts-esque.
No, that's true. You're right.
But maybe that gets to a question too. It's not directly related to this, but kind of tangentially is we've talked about, you know, some of the complications of like external, internal, and how it relates to the two institutions, and then how those institutions relate to the idea of two kingdoms and all that. But what authority in that, and then you've kind of talked about it, you've kind of articulated a type of faithful presence of Christians kind of infiltrating society as kind of like leavening the dough of society, you know, or something like that. But what would you say also, and you know, this is, you know, maybe I'm interested to see how you answer this, and maybe it's just, oh, that sounds Catholic, you know, but But what is the, does the, what authority, if any, does the church itself have pertaining to temporal matters? So as we think about trying to renew the nation, and we think about, yeah, not only do we want to foster individuals to be virtuous within the nation and to take up those positions of authority, but is there any role, you know, is there any authoritative presence that the church itself as a body has related to broader society?
Yeah. Well, that sounds Catholic, James, but
yes, I knew it.
Yeah, I mean, no, obviously the primary way in which the church exercises authority is through the proclamation of the word, right? And this is, and bearing witness to, bearing witness sometimes against political authorities. Now, I think there's a profound challenge there in terms of the fact that, like, most of the time, the political disputes, they hinge on matters that obviously there are bedrock moral principles there that the church has an interest in. And then there are all kinds of circumstantial realities that church leaders are very poorly versed in often, right? So this is where you get the kind of, you know, the kind of walking caricature of, like, you know, the United Methodists or whatever, like making this, always making this statement against, you know, that this war is unjust or that war is unjust, mm-hmm. or whatever, right? And it might be that they're all unjust, but it's also like, do they really actually have the information necessary to make that determination? Not necessarily. So, I mean, the fact of the matter is, and war is obviously an important thing. An unjust war is a big deal. And mm-hmm. yet, and it's something that the church should bear witness against if it's happening. And yet the church has to recognize that the statesman's craft will include a lot of, you know, epistemic access that they don't have, right? So mm-hmm. I think that's why it's, you know, it's important for the church to be, like, very courageously, unashamedly proclaiming unpopular truths that have a bearing on current political debates, mm-hmm. while being very careful about stepping beyond that into analysis of particular policies. You know, this happens obviously, like, environmental issues, you know, as well. And so, like, whenever the church does that, it really just kind of discredits itself. It's like, oh, this is just a bunch of, you know, ministers who don't know what they're talking about. So I think that's now part of the answer to that. So part of the answer is more epistemic humility on the part of ministers, just, and part of it is better political training for ministers. So if they are going to be called to speak up, then we can either say speak up less, or we can say speak up more intelligently. And it is significant, the fact that it used to be, if you look at the 17th, 18th centuries, you know, the training, seminary training included, you know, moral philosophy, political philosophy. They, you know, they knew their Aristotle and their Plato and their Cicero, and they, you know, a minister was actually expected to be conversant in what good politics looked like. And of course, our ministers now don't have any of that training. And so, of course, often when they open up their mouths, they say stupid stuff. So I think a lot of the answer has to be, well, you know, it's what the classical education movement is trying to accomplish, I think. I think we're still in the early days of that retrieval. But if we can actually have, like, robustly classically educated clergy, then they'll be able to use that proclamatory authority in a way that's, you know, actually intelligent. So
you're including the Bible, surely, as one of the primary political texts.
Yes,
that was another oversight. You didn't mean to leave it out when you were listing off political sources.
Well, I'm saying the things that they that they used to have that they don't have. I mean, we still teach the Bible, but we do not teach the Bible as that much as a source of political knowledge in the way that that we should. I think, you know, Alistair Roberts is doing fantastic work on that, and that requires a kind of, I mean, I would say it's related in the sense that if you don't learn those other, here's what I'm saying, right? If you don't learn those other arts, then you won't learn how to read the Bible in light of those other arts, right? I mean, I think, Peter, part of the reason you're such a great reader of scripture is because you're well-trained in literature. You know how to read other literature well, and you apply those skills of reading literature well to reading the Bible well. And I would say similarly, a minister who's well-trained as a political philosopher is going to be have a much more robust hermeneutic than one who's not.
Yeah. And again, surely vice versa too, because the reading of the Bible enables you to read Aristotle, Plato, Cicero differently and faithfully.
Yes. Amen.
Right. Yeah. So I wanted to, just to clarify what you were getting at there, the original explanation you gave, or the original example you gave, was the Methodist Church intervening with every war, declaring it unjust. But it sounded like the conclusion of the discussion was, at least you're leaving open the option that that might be a valid use of church authority and witness if it's well-informed and if you have ministers or others within the church who have certain kinds of insight. I guess I just registered parenthetical skepticism that the political authorities who are making the decisions are that much better informed than other people are. I'm slightly skeptical of that assumption. But the more important point was that you would say that a public witness, even in cases complicated things like judging the justice of war, is valid ground for a church that really does know what it's talking about. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I mean, I think the statement should still be sort of couched in as kind of hypothetical syllogisms, right? I mean, the church says, on the basis of what God has revealed, here are the conditions that this war would have to meet. And it doesn't look to us like it meets those conditions. On the first one, we proclaim with, 100% confidence. The second one, we recognize we could be wrong, right? So there's an element of contingency in the judgment, sure, right? And that's where I would say it's different from, say, a papal bull that says, I sort of authoritatively pronounce that this is unjust. Right?
Let me ask another. It's along the similar lines. This is from your essay Against Religious Liberty. Again, a parenthetical comment, Brad. You sure sounded like a presuppositionalist here. I know that was inadvertent. But you say ultimately at stake in such debates are disagreements about what actually is harmful in the final analysis, and there is no religiously neutral ground for making these determinations. I agree with that completely. But then I want to ask again: somebody is making those decisions about what constitutes harm. The church have some role to play in making those judgments about what constitutes harm, or should the state be attentive to the church in what it decides on those kind of, you're talking about kind of a foundational issue with trying to set the boundaries between tolerable and intolerable religious behavior. Is that a judgment that the state makes without input from the church? Is it something the state makes with the church's advice and consultation?
I would say the latter. I would say, for instance, in terms of pandemic restrictions, a church should be able to say, hey, just so you know, not receiving the Eucharist, for 6 months or a year is actually deeply harmful to someone. So that doesn't have to be the decisive factor, but it should be at least an important factor that you're taking into account in your calculus, right?
It'd be good if our Christians also knew that.
Yes, indeed.
I remarked on that too. For people who don't know about that, it's a very good essay that gets the seven propositions for a Protestant conception of the common good. You reproduce also in your Christian Commonwealth article. But I did remark on, points 1 through 3 are really, really interesting, and they're really tightly woven together. You start with kind of the government is should be ordered towards praising the good and penalizing the bad, and then okay, so that's point one. Point two was, how does it discern those things? Well, it discerns them by natural law, but natural law is clarified by Scripture, and then it's encapsulated often in the Decalogue, as understood in classical Protestant thought. But one of the things that is I remarked also independently of Peter, I'm glad he brought it up, was, yes, is the church, does it have any role in helping interpret those things? I'm glad we brought this up. But would you have anything further to say on that, or we can move on to another issue?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just trying to think if there's a, good historical example that I could point to, right? This is how the relationship is understood in the Reformation, right? That the Edward VI of England, right? It is his responsibility as magistrate to punish the evil and praise the good. It's to prevent harm to his subjects, to promote the flourishing of his subjects, and he is turning to the ministers to tell him that, hey, based on our study of scripture, this, you know, pervasive use of icons in worship is actually deeply deforming to people's souls. And therefore, as king, you should get rid of these things, right? They use language of mutual subjection, right? So as ministers are subject to the authority of the magistrate, and that they can't defy his outward commands, they cannot physically resist his outward commands, in the sense that they can't take up arms against his outward commands. Obviously, if he commands something that is against God, they can refuse to do it and then accept, you know, take the punishment, go to prison. But even in taking the punishment, they're still being subject to him, right? Mm-hmm. But the magistrate is subject to the minister, in that he is supposed to listen to the minister's proclamation out of God's word about how he can best do his job. Now, they qualify that by saying, since we're Protestants, there's a priesthood of all believers, in the sense that the magistrate is also capable of reading scripture. He's not chained to the word of the minister. And I think this is an important point where I would say we need to be careful when we talk about the authority of the church in teaching or disciplining a Christian political leader, that the Christian layman has access to the word as well. And a minister is more likely, because of his greater training, he's more likely to interpret it well. But his interpretation doesn't automatically trump the Christian magistrates. So Edward VI could say, you guys are all telling me this, but I mean, my reading the Bible, which probably wouldn't be smart for Edward VI because he died when he was like 16. So, you know, it would not just be a layman, but it would be a youth, you know, defying all of the ministers. But in principle, he could do it, right?
I wanted to, this was not the focus of your essay on the Christian Commonwealth. You left nationalism behind, but I was interested in what you were saying early on in the essay about nations and nationalism in a couple of respects. Let me pose it as a question, then a set of comments that will follow up. You start with nationalism, you don't define what a nation is. So I'm interested to know how you're defining that term. And I'm interested to know, especially in the light of the acknowledgement that you have in the essay, that what we think of as modern nations, many of them are, well, you list a handful of them, but there are more. They are the result of a overcoming of sectional differences, regional differences. I think in some cases it's accurate to say they're the result of sectional imperialism. There's one region that ends up becoming dominant over other regions. I'm thinking about 19th century Italy. And so, given that origin story of modern states, modern nations, not only what is a nation, but how is a nation distinguished? You're like Yoram Hazzoni, you seem to be death on empire, but it seems to me there's an imperial source for what we think of as the modern nation state, or at least in many cases. So how do you define a nation in a way that distinguishes it actually from an imperial structure?
Yep. Yeah, I think, I mean, what I would always insist, there's a sort of sliding scale here. There's a place where a nation shades over into an empire, and they're not hermetically sealed categories. But I would say I guess Benedict Anderson used the term for nations of imagined communities. And I think it's important to emphasize both sides of that, to understand a nation is imagined, but it is also in some genuine sense a community. So unlike you could have a small region state, city, state, whatever, that is a real community in the sense that there are obvious things shared in common. Like all of us, we have a sort of shared life. Our lives intersect with one another's in many ways. There's shared customs, religions, idioms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have to do that much imagining because we see it's visible. It's obvious to that there's a community there, a shared way of life. Whereas a nation is a large enough thing that it requires a significant element of imagination to see everyone in France as sharers in some kind of common life. But imagination is not the same as invention. The imagination here still has to rest. I would say for a nation to succeed, the imagination of the nation has to touch down in reality at many points, right? So it needs to be able to point to certain really shared customs, laws, religious beliefs. More importantly, I would say, and Ernst Renan is good on this, is shared experiences that a nation comes to be often out of sectional elements when those sectional elements are forced to make common cause against some adversary or in the face of some great trial or danger. And that shared experience, that memory of a shared experience of fighting side by side, then actually creates a community where one didn't necessarily exist before, right? So all of that in contrast. So I would say an empire doesn't make claims to that. An empire says, look, we know you guys are a bunch of heterogeneous peoples. The only thing that unites you is the fact that we rule over you. We're the authority. You all look to a common center, but that's it, right? A nation does have to have certain shared bonds that are at least a kind of raw material out of which the imagination can construct something deeper.
Yeah, I wonder if that, again, I appreciate your mentioning the sliding scale. That's not the impression I get from Hezzoni's book on nations. The distinction is pretty sharp there.
Yes.
But I think the sliding scale goes the other way too, because, you know, my understanding is that the people of Philippi, though not ethnically Roman, and though a conquered or a contracted subject of Rome, considered themselves to be Romans. So there are imperial elements that have that share some of the imagination that you're talking about with nations and maybe even common experiences. You know, to what extent are the frontiers of the Roman Empire defending against Persian incursions, sharing the experience of repelling the Persians with people at the capital? I mean, it seems like you would have an overlap in that direction too. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting case study because, you know, it's sort of like if even the Roman Empire, the sort of ultimate empire, turns out to have national characteristics, then is this distinction useful at all? I mean, but I think... and I would say I mean, part of the reason Rome was so durable is because it did extend citizenship, right? It was this weird hybrid, in the sense that, like, yeah, obviously the Persian Empire and the Assyrian Empire, whatever, didn't try to do it. It's like, look, we conquered you, you got to give us tribute, you got to serve in our army, you know, you're a subject people, just deal with it. And whereas Rome actually tries to invite a lot of the subject peoples into a kind of shared imaginative experience where they see themselves as fellow Romans. I think the problem is it's so massive and unwieldy that's what's going on in the last decades of the Republic, is that's like we're adding more and more and more people to the Republic. They're all Romans. And it's like, no, this is kind of obviously a fiction because they're not able to participate in a shared government. And so therefore, the only way this is going to work is if we have a sort of despot running the show. And then how do you get shared, shared participation? Well, it's by the kind of the cult of emperor worship, right? So I think it's less. Yeah, I mean, there are obviously certain shared things that tie the Roman Empire together, but they seem to be things that all revolve around the kind of status of subjection to the ruler, right? Whereas a nation fosters a sense of actual self-government.
Everything you said in your earlier description up until the worship of the emperor sounded like a pretty good description of the contemporary state of America. And so I hope that's not a predictive of where we're going. But
right. It is one of the great questions of all this discussion is, can America actually function as a nation, or is it just really an imperial unit? It's just too big, right? Mm-hmm.
I wanted to come back, as I always do. I want to come back to a question about ecclesiology, because and thinking about nations, and I want at a couple of different angles. One is, you acknowledge in the essay, and I know you would affirm that the church is a multi-ethnic. I really appreciated the critique of ethnic and racial forms of nationalism in your essay. And one of the arguments was that, you know, we now have a multi-ethnic, multi-racial communion, which is the church. To what extent, if at all, do you think that disrupts the entity called the nation? That's at one level. The other level is, you talk about an international order of nations, but the international order of nations has to have some kind of shared values to recognize one another's independence. In the mm-hmm. section of the essay where you're talking about the church as a multi-ethnic people, you talk about nations now in the New Covenant acknowledge each other across national boundaries in a kind of brotherhood. So there can be harmony among nations, distinct nations, but it's because there's some overarching shared values or some overarching shared culture. I mean, it seems to me historically in Europe that comes from Christendom, that dreaded and evil medieval imperialism. You didn't use dreaded and evil, but you did talk about medieval imperialism. But it seems like that overarching thing requires something that's transcendent of nations. So at a couple of different levels, it looks like the church as a new kind of community in the world disrupts the categories of nation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that latter one, is that the church disrupting the nation or actually making it possible? Because I would say without the premise that people of different nations should sort of recognize each other's right to exist as nations, right? That's what, when Hazzoni talks about nationalism, he says it's sort of a principled stance. It doesn't merely say there are nations and that people like their nations. It says it is a good thing that there should be independent nations kind of acknowledging one another's right to exist, right? Now, the acknowledgement of one another's right to exist, as opposed to seeing nations as sort of caught in a dog-eat-dog world of each pursuing their own interests and devouring one another up, that possibility of harmony among independent is, as you note, part of the influence of the church on the Western world. So I would say there, it's not the church disrupting the order of nations, it's the church making the order of nations possible precisely by relativizing it, right? It's like the problem with the Third Reich is it's a nationalism that treats the nation as an end in itself, as some transcendent thing, a transcendent good in pursuit of which many other goods can be sacrificed. And so the Third Reich ends up devouring all the nations around it. A stable nationalism only happens when a nation sees itself as good, but sees itself as a penultimate good. And so it's a political imagination disciplined by the church that makes nationalism possible, I would say.
Right. What about the other side of it? You have within a nation, within a Christian nation, you have members of a church, that is members of a communion of people that extends beyond the boundaries of the nation. So there's a potentially fifth column reality where you've got a resistant, contemporary China. You have a resistant element within the regime, and the Chinese recognize it as a potential threat to the regime, so they try to suppress it. That's what I had. Yeah, you're right about the overarching effect of Christendom, but then the disruptive part is the presence of this other entity within a nation.
Yes, and I think there's a kind of a humility on both sides is called for that to be able to function, right? So on the part of the church, it calls for the kind of humility we were talking about earlier. So, I mean, what we're talking about concretely is like a situation in which two neighboring nations full of Christians go to war with each other. All right. So you could say, oh, wow, they're both full of Christians. Shouldn't the Christians be more loyal to one another than they are to their own nations? Shouldn't they, you know, refuse to fight for their governments because they're being asked to fire upon fellow Christians? Well, the answer to that is just because they're both made up of Christians doesn't mean that one can't, you know, be unjust vis-a-vis the other. Two Christians can fight each other and one of them be unjust relative to the other. They can, in fact, fight each other, and both of them honestly think that they are fighting justly against each other. And it's possible for two Christian nations to go to war, both honestly thinking that they are in the right. And I think the church in that situation has to have the humility of not assuming that it's an expert on all the circumstances of the conflict, and therefore, it can sort of say, this war has to stop, right? The church needs to be able to defer to the decision of political authorities saying, no, this is, in fact, a just war. Okay. On the other hand, though, those political authorities do have to be able to make a plausible case that it is a just war. And this very language of just war, right, is a creation of, Christianity working itself out in international law. A state cannot just go to war against a neighboring state on the grounds that it wants to, on the grounds that its national interest is better served by devouring this other state's territory. The fact that you have neighboring Christian nations potentially going to war with each other means that statesmen have to be able to justify that war as only serving certain limited ends, right? And so I would say to that extent, yes, the presence of the church is disruptive. It constrains the freedom of action of statesmen by saying, look, if you're going to ask us to go to war against other Christians, you're going to have to make a compelling case for it within these criteria.
Well, thanks, Brad. That was really good. Very helpful, helping us think through some practical things, but also deeper theoretical issues. And we're grateful for your work as you continue to engage the contemporary debates, but also grounded in the classical Protestant tradition and helping other Christians think through these things. And so we're grateful for you joining us here on the podcast as we continue to wrestle with teasing out our project and our contribution to the broader discourse by inviting thoughtful figures in kind of adjacent projects like yourself here. So thanks for joining us and having this great conversation.
Thanks. My pleasure.